This podcast is brought to you by Money Control.
Hello and welcome to yet another episode of Simply Save at Money Control, a show that talks about money, investments and savings. In this season, we've been talking to fund managers about the importance to look at companies beyond the numbers. In today's podcast, we catch up with Huzaifa Hussain, who is the head of Indian equities at Pinebridge Investments. Pinebridge earlier was a mutual fund house in India as well, where Huzaifa was the head of equities. And Huzaifa has always been an astute fund manager driven by conviction. He has always liked holding few stocks and higher chunks of those few companies. In this podcast, he tells us why a company's CEO is so important to run a successful business, why it's important to assess a company's biases, and why it's important for a good portfolio manager to try and go beyond the benchmark indices. Let's listen to Huzaifa to understand how to become a better stocks investor. Hi Huzaifa, welcome to our podcast.
Hi Kazat.
So how's the shift been like from the Indian mutual fund industry to, you know, managing money for foreign investors? Of course, you'd still track Indian markets, but are you kind of relieved? And most mutual fund managers complain that, you know, NAVs are being tracked on a daily basis. It's a very kind of a short-term performance-driven observation by many people. Are you relieved to get out of that and like really, really focus on what you're really good at?
I would say that investing in mutual funds or advising foreign investors is not very different. Yes, there is daily NAV, but when one looks at the numbers, one realizes that the churn in the portfolio is higher than the churn amongst the investors.
Okay.
So which means the investors actually give fund managers a longer rope than what probably portfolio managers like to think.
Okay.
So it is up to the portfolio manager to be able to communicate to the investors and take advantage of the longer rope which the investor has given. So my job is just to do that. And as long as clients are happy, I'm happy.
Okay. But speaking of churn, your portfolios, even when you were running the Indian mutual fund, your portfolio churn was still one of the lowest in the industry. I mean, is that you, your style, or did it come after lessons being learned or something? How did it evolve?
I started my career as a research analyst. And as a research analyst, the fundamental basis of investing is understanding company and its future prospects.
Okay.
And future prospects, they change very slowly. So if you think about a company, they are barely 4 results in a year. That's all. And if I'm projecting for a company for the next 3 to 5 years, that trajectory does not change every day.
Okay.
But the stock price does change every day.
Okay.
So therefore, on a research-based framework, it is very hard to find an approach whereby every day we can decide to buy or sell. So therefore, it is but natural that when one does a lot of research, one tends to hold the stock for a longer period of time.
Okay. So, Huzaifa, you know, when you have annual reports, you have balance sheets, you have a lot of figures at hand when you're evaluating whether to buy a stock or not to buy a stock, even when you are kind of evaluating a company in general. But what about other factors? Like, how do you go? Do you ever go beyond the numbers?
Yes. I think one of the important things one should look for is the person who's managing the enterprise or the company, which typically would be a CEO or MD.
Okay.
The job of a CEO is basically to allocate capital efficiently, for which he requires to be proficiently skilled in the business. And second, he should be honest custodian of shareholder capital.
Okay.
So to give you some example, if you take the skilled portion as a requirement, in the past decade, 10-12 years, you have seen that in the Western world, a lot of financial institutions fell foul of regulations.
Okay.
And under pressure, legally proficient or lawyers became CEOs of such companies.
Okay.
While that helps such companies avoid any future violation of laws, as a shareholder, you should maybe think about whether a lawyer is the right person to run a financial institution or not.
Okay.
So therefore, the skill level for a CEO is important. The other part would be, he's the custodian of shareholder capital. And how does he take care of your money? Now here from India, I can give you two examples, and both have been extremely successful companies. But it's interesting to see how both of them have behaved.
Okay.
So one is a company in the healthcare industry,
okay,
which went through turbulent times, and the CEO decided to not just forgo his salary, but also decided not to take his share of dividends.
Okay.
He also is owner of the company, a large owner of the
company. This was in troubled times.
Yes. On the other hand, a very successful auto ancillary company, there the owner manager takes salary which is higher than the total dividends paid out by the company.
Okay. Wow.
So it's up to you which one of these two would fit your value system. You can decide to invest. Both have been very successful.
Okay. So it's not just the actual profit numbers, it just, but you need to take a look at the behavioral aspects of the attitude of the CEO, the management quality also, the approach of the management towards the company and its employees also. That actually makes a difference, you say.
A huge difference. The value system, the culture of the organization.
Okay.
And as I said, the CEO has to keep the shareholder in mind because he's the custodian of their hard-earned money.
Do you ever try and go beyond the CEO of a company, like speaking to other people within the company? Some people say that, you know, when they go for factory visits, they like to talk to people on the floor.
Yeah, recently I was attending a shareholder meeting of a manufacturing company, and it was held within the factory premises.
Okay.
So I got a chance to speak to some people who are working.
A shareholder meeting held in the factory premises?
In the factory premises. And these people generally would otherwise not meet shareholders. So in a sense, as you said, they are not prepped up for the meeting.
Okay.
And I was speaking to them and their experiences working with the company. Some of them had been working there for 2 to 3 decades.
Oh, okay.
And so the consistent theme was they actually had very nice things to say about the management, the way the company treated them. They said the company gives us autonomy, gives them respect. Takes care of their children. For example, they had built a beautiful school of international standards which could help educate their children. So it is but natural for such employees to reciprocate the goodness of the company.
So it helps also the if the employees are happy, the companies are happy. And if the company is happy, then at least, you know, it's on the right path.
Yes, in a competitive world, that small edge is what is required.
Okay.
Because manufacturing is an industry anybody can open. I mean, the technology is out there. So there's no intellectual property per se which can differentiate you. The brand, to some extent, can differentiate. But beyond that, it is the people who are in the company who deal with, daily with customers, with machines, or whatever it is.
Okay. I'm sure you have a full-fledged research team under you. Do you guys do all the number crunching, all the research in-house? Do you ever talk to sell-side analysts, get outside opinion about a particular company, second opinion or third opinion? And does it really matter in your scheme of things?
Yes, I believe in good research. The source of its genesis is of little consequence to me.
Okay. You know, earlier we were talking about how you interact with the managements and companies. You know, how do you, as a fund manager, I mean, you've been in the industry for a long time, how do you assess whether if whatever they're saying is true or, you know, it's a colored opinion? How do you get through that?
I think it is important to understand the biases of company management. A company whose success is dependent on continuous capital raising may find it hard to talk about slowdown.
Like, for example?
You know, take the case of a bank where a CEO has been given a lot of employee stock options, which are maturing, say, in the next 2 to 3 years.
Okay.
It would be hard for such a person to say things which can potentially harm the stock price.
Okay, I see where you
Or you take a company which relies a lot on debt capital, wherein the generosity of lenders is very important, or the benevolence of lenders is very important for that capital to remain, because the bank can call back the loan anytime.
Yeah.
Now, imagine such a company going around saying, you know, everything is bad and, you know, we are not able to sell things and economy is poor. You never know which bank may pull out.
Yeah.
So such companies may find it difficult to tell you what exactly is happening, especially if things are not happening on the good side.
Okay.
So once you know their position and where they're coming from, then it is very easy to discount some factors and then take whatever is relevant to deciding whether the company is a good investment or not.
Okay. I mean, you seem to have a lot of parameters beyond the numbers when picking up stocks. With all these insights, I mean, do you find yourself going away from the benchmark index? I mean, I know you used to do that a lot when you used to manage funds for Indian investors. But do you still do that a lot when you run funds for offshore entities?
Yeah, I think that is important because ETFs today are the cheapest option to buy an index.
Okay.
And they are active managers' biggest competition.
Okay.
So why would anybody pay an active manager whose fees are much higher than an index to buy a replica of the index?
Okay.
Makes no sense. Therefore, it is imperative that the active manager looks away from the index and finds stocks which can do better than the index to earn his fees.
Okay.
So typically in our portfolio, you would see that the active share is the difference between what you own and what the index has.
Okay.
So the larger the number, the more away you are.
Okay.
So typically we run portfolios with active shares of around 75%. So 75% of our portfolio is actually different than the index.
Benchmark index.
So Well, you have to do it because an investor can always buy an ETF at a far lower cost.
But you're also running the risk of going away from the benchmark. So when the markets are in trouble or going down, your fund might tend to underperform more than the peers. So that risk is okay.
As long as you can explain it to your clients when they are investing as to what exactly you're doing, that is not much of a risk because they already know it. If you are going to invest away from the index and yet compare the performance with the index, there are going to be periods when there is going to be divergence.
Okay.
As long as the divergence is within the stated parameters, I think it will not be a problem. So if you want the pendulum to swing positive, then it is but natural that sometimes it's going to swing the other way around. So that is the characteristic of the fund.
Okay. The other characteristic of your fund is that you would like to hold concentrated portfolios. I mean, not like a sector fund or something, but much more concentrated than, let's say, a plain vanilla diversified equity fund.
Yes.
So how did that strategy came about when you started managing funds?
I think it's quite natural and quite commonsensical, I would say, because high conviction bets come out of the research done by the team. And once you find a good stock to invest, why would you be stingy in buying the name?
Okay.
Would you not want to own as much as possible of a good company available at a good price? So I do agree volatility may be high, may be low. But again, in my view, there is no correlation between volatility and the return generated by a portfolio. It is an unfortunate and probably very common misconception that volatility of a stock or a portfolio and the returns the stock or the portfolio generate are somehow linked. Actually, it is untrue.
Okay.
I'll give you an example from my own experience. Somewhere in 2006, we first bought a mid-sized cement company. And the stock, I think within a year, went up threefold. And then when the financial crisis happened, it came down by 80%.
Okay.
So it went up three times. Then it came down, I mean, it lost four-fifths of its value.
Then you still stuck on
it. Yeah, actually we added more to a position when it went down. And then very soon, it went up seven times.
Okay.
So I would say between 2006 and 2010, the 3 or 4 years, so it went up three times, it came down 80%, and then it went up sevenfold.
Okay.
Now, if you do any kind of statistical analysis, it will be proven that this is a very, very volatile, very risky stock. Today, the stock is up ninefold from 2010.
Okay.
So that is, it went up sevenfold and then it went up ninefold on top of it. So today, from the base of 2008, when it was the lowest, the stock is up some 60, 65 times.
Okay.
So it proves that short-term volatility and long-term returns are absolutely uncorrelated.
Okay. So you still continue, even when you're managing money for offshore entities, you still continue to hold a concentrated portfolio?
Yes, I think there are not so many great businesses in the world. Once you find some of them, invest and stay with them. Yes, they will go through their own business cycles, but that's part and parcel of investing. If you can just take it in your stride, the longer term, good companies keep generating good returns.
Okay. And do you ever find yourself in a situation where, you know, you bought something and then after a few months you had to reevaluate your decision because of some events have happened in the middle, or maybe you realize that, you know, it was a mistake, you shouldn't have done it? Either ways.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's our job to continuously monitor developments in the companies we invest and take appropriate action. Typically, it is not so much as to getting surprised on the characteristics of the business, because that gets covered in our
primary research.
The one area which we struggle in, which is where mistakes happen, is predicting human behavior.
Okay.
Because as I started off saying, the CEO is so critical to the whole investment thesis. What he does with the money is most important. So we had once invested in a large services company which was generating a huge amount of cash flows.
Okay.
And we thought it's a great business. It had a moat. The business was assured. The cash flows were assured.
Okay. And you bought the stock.
And we bought a significant percentage of the portfolio in that stock.
Okay.
However, one day the company decided to use the cash flows and acquire a company which was in a suboptimal return environment.
Okay.
So they took money and invested in another asset, a large, materially large asset, and thereby the overall returns generated by the business came crashing down.
Okay. But acquisitions happen all the time.
And unfortunately, most of them happen at prices which are unremunerative to the acquiring company.
Okay.
So there are two things in an acquisition. One is the company you acquire.
Yeah.
So the inherent return generated by that company on the assets that company employs.
Mm.
Now, even if that is good, but when you are paying, you pay far higher than the assets.
Okay.
So therefore, the returns generated by that company on your purchase price suddenly drops.
Okay.
So therefore, what happens is, if you are acquiring a large company, which can materially alter the overall company's return profile, then yes, then you'll have to reevaluate. And maybe if you think no longer fits your initial thesis, you may have to sell it.
So what did you do?
We sold it.
You sold it. Okay. Huzaifa, when you know you used to manage funds for Indian investors, obviously you had plenty of peers, plenty of competitors over here in the industry. I'm sure even in the space that you operate right now, also you will have many, many peers. Do you ever kind of get their portfolio? I mean, I know that you told me earlier that, you know, you kind of don't stick to the benchmark index. You know, pay a lot of attention to your in-house research and you want to go away from the benchmark. But do you ever look at peer validation? Is that ever important? Like, you know, some ideas which are there in your portfolio, but they are not there in your other competitors' peers' portfolios. Does that kind of make you nervous or second thoughts? Or on the other hand, if you buy something and which is there in other portfolios, does that give you kind of a validation? Or is it like extremely independent?
No, I think our focus is more on what we have promised our clients as to how we will take care of their money. And the focus is to ensure that we do not deviate from the promise we have made, irrespective of what others are doing.
Okay.
We have full respect for them, but then we have promised something to the client and the client has chosen us instead of our peers.
Mm.
So obviously we have to satisfy the promise which we have made to them.
Okay.
And in today's day and age, I think our biggest competitor is a low-cost index fund.
Okay.
So if you were saying a peer, I mean, the peer is the index fund. So that's it. Other than that, yes, there are some investors we do keep track of who we respect.
Okay.
And they may not necessarily be managing similar strategies which we do.
Mm.
But we can learn from them because they are more experienced, manage more money, invest in different other markets. So an example would be Warren Buffett.
Okay.
Studying his investing career from 1951 to 2019, compounding at an enormous rate, gives you a lot of ideas in terms of how to invest, and the respect he gets when he does a shareholder meeting. Tens of thousands of shareholders travel to attend.
Have you ever attended his shareholder meeting?
No, I have not attended. So people who travel there listen to him. It shows admiration for somebody who has achieved something. So yes, he's a great role model to emulate. But that is more on the investment side because he doesn't invest in India. So I think our whole focus is the customer is important. Whatever we have promised, we stick to that.
Okay.
We don't get swayed by what somebody else is doing.
Okay. And when you invest on behalf of your foreign institutional investors, as opposed to, let's say, when you were investing here on behalf of your Indian investors and distributors, how differently do you think your fund gets evaluated? What do they see? What do people here used to see? How is it different?
This answer might sound surprising, but it doesn't matter what kind of investors you are, whether it's foreign or domestic. What actually matters is whether the investor is a principal or an agent.
Okay.
So due diligence done by principals is different than due diligence done by agents.
The principal is the one who's the direct investor?
Yeah, it's his own money.
It's his own money, yeah.
Maybe a very rich person or agent would be a distributor, an employee of an organization working on behalf of somebody, like a sovereign wealth fund. Or an agent could be a relationship manager in a bank. These are people who are investing on behalf of somebody.
The principal would be the direct investor.
Yeah, it could be a family. You know, so we do have investors who are, I've met people who have their own personal money in the, so they are the principals and they are the agents.
Okay.
And we had similar experience in India also.
Okay.
So when we are dealing with a principal, or a person who's investing his or her own money, the focus is generally on intangibles such as investment philosophy, our value system, our dedication, our strength to stand for our convictions, etc.
They ask you all these questions, don't they?
Yes, in a way they will ask us and try to understand we as people. Because I think they want to invest with like-minded individuals. But when an agent is doing a due diligence, then the focus is more on tangible numbers like performance, portfolio, or, you know, exact process, those kind of things. I guess that's because agents need to justify their choices to their principals, and hence they focus on more tangible things which they can show. Mm. But principals themselves, they just want somebody who will take care of their money without putting it at any to any form of risk.
When you're investing foreign money in India, like what you're doing right now, you must be dealing with more principals than agents, right?
No, no, it is it's agents, because when a bank has selected us to put us on a distribution platform, we'll be dealing with employees of banks. Okay. So it's a mix. So okay. I've met both. I mean, there could be family members who are investing their own personal money.
Give me a sample of the kind of questions that some of the principals abroad would ask you, because, you know, the kind of money that they would be putting in a country like India, so far away. What are the concerns that they would like to be addressed by you? Like, what are the most striking things that would have taken you by surprise, questions that they would ask you?
So, for example, one of them asked me as to what was my passion to do this job, and to which I responded that this country has given me education. I told them my overall education, from schooling to college to graduation to post-graduation, I think my total tuition fees would not be more than slightly over 2 lakh rupees.
Okay.
Of course, this is the period between 1980 and 1997, 17 years. The tuition fees was far, far lower than the knowledge which was imparted in.
Okay.
So, in return, I felt that I should offer my services to the country.
Oh.
And by making a small contribution and allocating capital efficiently, I think I am trying to repay the society's debts. So this was the kind of conversation. He immediately said, yeah, I understand what you're doing. And so there were no questions on, you know, what's your salary, what's your bonus, will you stick around, which would be a typical question which would be asked by an agent.
Yeah.
Why are you working for this company? Why don't you leave? Why don't you go? So that's one approach.
Okay.
It's a very tangible, point by point. And this is a very different approach.
Yeah. The same tangibles.
So it's an intangible. It's much more,
much more personal.
Yeah, personal, and you know, and then you can, then the person can, because see, such people have been successful in their lives. I mean, that's why they are principals.
Mm.
So they have met enough people,
okay.
So they can easily judge what drives a person.
Okay.
So when they invest, then they will not ask you every quarter what the performance is, because they know
in general things are happening.
Things will go up and down, and they must have experienced that in their own personal lives.
What else do you get asked?
I think one of the questions most people, which is kind of a common also, is the periods when the portfolio is not performing in line with the market.
Okay.
How do you handle those kind of periods? What kind of support your organization gives you?
Okay.
Because we work for an organization, and organization support has to be there.
Absolutely.
So those kind of questions come, which we then show historical periods when performance may have been underperforming. Then we show how we communicate it to the client. So we have to communicate to the client. We have to be transparent about it. We have to explain to the client.
Is communication very important?
Very, very, very.
Sacrosanct.
Yeah, very. No amount of communication is enough.
No amount of communication is enough.
Our organization, you know, produces a fact sheet every month where we write commentary.
Okay.
But I would say no amount of communication is enough. Because you may, when you're talking to a potential investor or an investor, you can identify whatever has happened historically and explain to them. But you don't know what is going to come tomorrow. So when that something happens tomorrow, you need to go back and again say.
Okay.
You cannot anticipate everything.
Yeah.
So I think communication, transparency, honesty. So just like we are looking for a CEO who can allocate capital efficiently for the company, they are looking for somebody who can allocate their capital efficiently. So just like whatever we demand of a company, they have a right to demand from us.
The fund managers. Okay, Uzifa, thank you so much for your lovely insights.
It was my pleasure, Kaza. Thank you very much.
And I'm sure our readers also would gain immensely from your insights.
That's all we have for you today, folks. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Over the next month and a half or so, we'll bring you many such conversations with some of our top fund managers around. If you have any feedback, anything to say, or any queries that you want to write to us, our email ID is mcpodcast@mw18.com. I repeat, it's mcpodcast@mw18.com. For more news, views, and updates, log on to moneycontrol.com.